Welcome to the Deep Dive. Today we're jumping into a really big topic, neurodegenerative diseases, NDDs for short. Think of this as laying the groundwork, giving you that core understanding you'll need, especially if you're heading into, say, a master's level neuroscience course. We'll be building on this later. Our goal today, to cut through some of the complexity. We want to give you the essential knowledge about these conditions, focusing especially on something crucial, misfolded proteins. Okay, so to kick us off, neurodegeneration, what does that actually mean? What's happening at the, you know, the basic level?
Right. So at its heart, neurodegeneration is this progressive loss of the structure of neurons or their function, often leading to the actual death of those neurons and even the glial cells around them. But there are a few characteristics that are really, really important to grasp. First, this idea of selective vulnerability.
Selective vulnerability, meaning only certain neurons are affected.
Exactly. Like, why in Parkinson's is it the dopaminergic neurons specifically that are so susceptible? Others nearby might be fine. It's a huge clue for researchers. You know, figuring that out could lead to really targeted treatments. Second, it's a chronic progression. This isn't something that happens overnight. The damage builds up silently, sometimes for years, even decades, before you see any symptoms.
Decades. Wow.
Yeah. And third, irreversibility.
Yeah.
Generally, once those neurons are lost, they're gone. The adult brain has pretty limited ability to regenerate them.
That idea of silent progression is, well, it's quite striking, isn't it? Like a disease marching on in secret. So this hidden start really shapes the whole timeline of the disease then. You mentioned phases. Can you break that down a bit?
Sure. Broadly, you've got two main phases. First is the pre-symptomatic phase. This is where the disease process has started at the molecular level inside the cells, but there are no signs you could detect. And like we said, this can go on for years, maybe even decades.
Okay. And then?
Then you move into the symptomatic phase. And even that has stages. It often starts with a prodromal stage, subtle signs, maybe non-specific things like mood changes or sleep problems, easily missed or put down to something else. But diagnosis might start happening here. Eventually, that leads to the full clinical stage where you get the overt textbook symptoms that progress over time. But get this, by the time someone's diagnosed with Parkinson's, for instance, they might have already lost up to 50% of those key dopaminergic neurons.
50%. That's huge before they even really know what's happening. And this silent start, this late diagnosis, it leads straight to one of the biggest hurdles in the field, doesn't it? The lack of early tests.
Absolutely. That's a massive challenge. We don't have reliable biomarkers, things we can easily measure early on for most of these diseases. So diagnosis often comes late, too late, really, for the kinds of interventions that might actually change the course of the disease. Hmm. Right now, we mostly lack therapies that can truly modify the disease, stop it, or reverse it. We mainly manage symptoms.
And the impact of this is not just personal, it's global, right?
Oh, completely. The scale is enormous. We're talking about an estimated 60 to 80 million people affected worldwide right now.
60 to 80 million.
And with populations aging, especially globally, that number is projected to more than double by 2050.
Double.
The economic cost is just staggering. It's expected to blow past $1 trillion annually by 2030. Alzheimer's alone drives a huge chunk of that. So yeah, it's way more than just a medical issue. It's this profound public health crisis, a massive socioeconomic burden. And you see disparities too. Wealthier countries report more cases, likely due to better diagnosis. But we're seeing sharp rises in low and middle income countries where the infrastructure to cope just isn't there.
It really puts it in perspective, such a widespread challenge. Okay, so despite all the different ways these diseases show up, memory loss in Alzheimer's, the motor problems in Parkinson's, muscle weakness in ALS, is there some common ground, like a shared mechanism underneath it all?
That's the million-dollar question, isn't it?
Yeah.
And yes, there is a really important unifying factor. Despite how different they look on the surface, many NDDs share this core pathology. The toxic buildup, the aggregation of misfolded proteins.
Misfolded proteins, okay.
Yeah. These clumps of proteins, these inclusions, they aren't just sitting there passively. They're actively messing with how neurons work and eventually contributing to their death. And each disease has its sort of signature proteins.
Right, like specific culprit.
Exactly. So for Alzheimer's, you've got those amyloid beta plaques outside the cells and the tau tangles inside. They typically start in memory areas like the hippocampus, then spread.
Okay, amyloid and tau for Alzheimer's. What about Parkinson's?
For Parkinson's, the main player is alpha-synuclein. It misfolds and clumps together into what we call Lewy bodies, especially in those dopamine-producing neurons in the substantia nigra.
Alpha-synuclein. Got it. And ALS.
With ALS, it's often proteins like TDP43 or sometimes SOD1 or FUS that aggregate in the motor neurons.
And Huntington's. That one's purely genetic, right?
Right. Huntington's is caused by a mutation in the Huntington gene, and it's the mutant Huntington protein itself that forms these inclusions, particularly in the basal ganglia. Now, connecting this back, there's a really critical idea gaining traction: the prion-like propagation hypothesis.
Prion-like? Like mad cow disease.
Sort of, yeah, the concept is similar. The idea is that these misfolded proteins can essentially act like a template. They cause normally folded healthy proteins of the same kind to misfold and aggregate too. And worse, they seem to be able to spread from one cell to another, moving along the brain's connections, the neural circuits. That could explain how the pathology progresses through the brain over time.
Wow. So the bad proteins basically infect the good ones. That's kind of scary. Is that fully accepted now?
The exact mechanisms, how they transfer between cells and trigger misfolding, are still being intensely researched. There's definitely debate on the details. But the general principle that protein aggregation spreads along specific pathways in the brain is, well, pretty widely accepted now as a key driver of disease progression. It really changes how we think about intervening.
Yeah, it opens up new targets trying to stop that spread. Okay, so we have this common theme of misfolded proteins. Now, how do these diseases actually start? We hear terms like idiopathic, sporadic, genetic. Can you clarify those?
Good point. Yeah, those terms can be a bit confusing. Idiopathic just means the cause is unknown, literally one's own suffering from the Greek. Sporadic means it seems to occur randomly, no clear pattern of inheritance in the family. They're often used pretty much interchangeably for cases where we don't know the specific trigger.
Okay, unknown cause or random occurrence. And genetic versus familial.
Right. Genetic means we know there's a specific gene mutation causing it. Familial means it runs in the family. Now, usually familial cases are genetic, but not always.
How?
Well, you could have a genetic case that's not familial if the mutation just happens spontaneously in that person, a de novo mutation. And technically, you could have a familial cluster that isn't strictly genetic if maybe shared environmental factors are playing a big role in that family. It's nuanced.
Interesting. So how does this breakdown look across the big NDDs?
It varies quite a bit. For Alzheimer's, the vast majority, like 95% to 99%, are considered late-onset idiopathic or sporadic. Only a small fraction, maybe 1% to 5%, are early-onset cases caused by specific gene mutations. Parkinson's is similar, about 85% to 90% sporadic and maybe 10% to 15% linked to known genetic factors. ALS also follows that pattern, roughly 90% sporadic, 10% familial genetic. But then you have Huntington's. That one's different. It's 100% genetic, caused by that single gene mutation passed down in a dominant way.
So Huntington's is the outlier, being purely genetic. How does knowing the split genetic versus sporadic actually help researchers?
Oh, hugely. If you know the exact gene, like in Huntington's or the genetic forms of other NDDs, you have a very specific target to study and potentially design therapies for. For the sporadic cases, which are the majority for AD, PD, and ALS, research has to look broader. You're investigating potential environmental triggers, maybe lifestyle factors, or combinations of smaller genetic risk factors that together increase susceptibility. It really dictates the research strategy.
Makes sense. It focuses the search. Okay, this sets us up perfectly to take a closer look at Parkinson's disease. I know this is a key example you use in the course materials. Let's unpack its progression and pathology a bit more. The numbers are stark, right? Around 10 million people worldwide.
Yeah, roughly 10 million currently, and like we mentioned, projections are heading towards maybe 17 million by 2040. Average diagnosis is typically late 50s, around 58, but importantly, about 10% of people develop it earlier, before age 40. That's early onset Parkinson's. And there's a slight skew towards men, about 60% of cases.
And etiology-wise, mostly sporadic.
Overwhelmingly, about 90% sporadic, where potential links to environmental factors like certain pesticides or past head injuries are investigated. The remaining 10% or so have identified genetic links involving mutations in genes like LRRK2 or SNCA, which codes for alpha-synuclein itself.
So let's talk symptoms. What are the defining features?
Parkinson's is classically defined by its motor symptoms. These are the hallmarks. First, tremor. Often starts in one limb, like a hand, and it's typically worse at rest, that pill rolling description you sometimes hear. Then bradykinesia. This is a real core feature. It means slowness of movement. But it's more than just slow. It's a difficulty initiating movement, a reduction in the amplitude or speed. You might see it as less facial expression, smaller handwriting, or a shuffling walk.
Okay, tremor, slowness.
Then rigidity. muscle stiffness. A clinician might feel it as resistance when they try to move a patient's limb, and later in the disease, postural instability. Problems with balance leading to a higher risk of falls. Sometimes also freezing of gait or aphagy. It's like the feet suddenly get stuck to the floor, often when trying to start walking, turn, or go through doorways.
Those are the classic motor signs. But you mentioned earlier these non-motor symptoms that can appear way earlier.
Yes, and this is incredibly important, especially for thinking about earlier diagnoses. These non-motor symptoms can predate the motor ones by, as we said, 10 or even 20 years. It's remarkable.
Like what specifically?
Things like chronic constipation, REM sleep behavior disorder, where people physically act out their dreams, depression or anxiety, and hyposmia, which is a reduced or lost sense of smell.
Loss of smell. 20 years before a tremor starts?
Potentially, yes. These aren't specific just to Parkinson's, which makes them tricky as diagnostic tools on their own. But they're significant potential early warning signs, reflecting that the disease process, the neurodegeneration, likely starts outside the substantia nigra and spreads there over time.
So pathologically, what's the smoking gun in Parkinson's?
Two main things really link together. First, the profound loss of those dopamine-producing neurons in the substantia nigra pars compacta. That dopamine depletion is what directly causes the motor symptoms, because dopamine is crucial for smooth, controlled movement via the basal ganglia circuits. Second, the presence of those protein aggregates we talked about, misfolded alpha-synuclein forming Lewy bodies and Lewy neurites within the remaining neurons. These clumps disrupt normal cell function and, as we discussed, are thought to spread, driving the progression.
So connecting all this, the long pre-symptomatic phase, the late diagnosis based on motor symptoms, the underlying neuronal loss and protein spread, it paints a tough picture for treatment, doesn't it?
It absolutely does. By the time motor symptoms lead to diagnosis, significant irreversible damage has already occurred. It highlights this desperate need for biomarkers to catch it earlier and, crucially, for disease-modifying therapies, treatments that target the underlying alpha-synuclein pathology or protect neurons to actually slow or stop the progression, not just mask the symptoms. That's the holy grail.
Absolutely, the ultimate goal. Okay, while Parkinson's is a vital case study, let's briefly touch on the other big players, Alzheimer's, ALS, Huntington's, just to reinforce that while they look different, that protein theme often recurs, and they each have unique features.
Definitely. Let's start with Alzheimer's disease, AD. It's the big one, the most common NDD, around 50 million people globally. Tends to affect women slightly more, about 65% of cases, and usually starts after age 65.
Yeah.
Clinically, it's known for that progressive memory loss, difficulties with thinking and reasoning, and later, changes in language and behavior. Pathologically, as we said, it's the amyloid plaques and tau tangles, starting in the hippocampus and spreading through the cortex.
Okay, Alzheimer's prevalence, memory focus, amyloid and tau. What about ALS?
Amyotrophic lateral sclerosis,
yeah.
ALS, something called Lou Gehrig's disease, affects fewer people, maybe 200,000 to 500,000 worldwide. Slightly more common in men, onset usually between 40 and 70. It's tragically rapid for most. Over 80% pass away within 2 to 5 years, typically from respiratory failure as the muscles controlling breathing weaken.
So fast.
Yeah. Symptoms are progressive muscle weakness, trouble speaking or swallowing, basically the loss of voluntary muscle control as the motor neurons die off. Pathologically, you see degeneration of those motor neurons, often with aggregates of proteins like TDP43, SOD1, or FUS. The speed makes it incredibly devastating and research incredibly urgent.
Such a brutal disease. And finally, Huntington's.
Huntington's disease, HD. This one's rare and, as we noted, purely hereditary. Caused by that single mutation in the HTT gene specifically, too many CAG repeats. Onset is usually midlife, 30s to 50s, though there's a juvenile form too. The hallmark symptoms are chorea, those involuntary sort of dance-like movements, plus cognitive decline and significant psychiatric problems like depression or irritability. Pathologically, it hits the basal ganglia and striatum hard with those intracellular clumps of the mutant Huntington protein. Even though we know the exact genetic cause, it's relentlessly progressive. People typically lose independence within a decade and survive maybe 15, 20 years after onset. It's a clear genetic target, but still incredibly challenging to treat effectively.
Right. A devastating trajectory, despite knowing the precise cause. Okay, we've covered a lot of ground today, from the basic definition to specific diseases. As we wrap up this deep dive, what are the big overarching takeaways, the threads connecting all these conditions?
I think three things really stand out. First, that selective vulnerability, why these neurons in this disease. Second, the progressive and irreversible nature of the damage once it starts. And third, that unifying theme, at least for many NDDs, of protein misfolding, aggregation, and that prion-like spread. Understanding these shared features alongside the unique aspects of each disease is just fundamental.
Hmm.
And given the, you know, the sheer global burden we discussed, it really hammers home the urgent need for better diagnostics, treatments that actually modify the disease, and ultimately ways to prevent them.
Absolutely. And that foundational knowledge is exactly what we aim to provide today, especially for those of you using this as a springboard for deeper study.
And on that note, to really connect with the human side of these conditions, I'd really encourage you to explore some other resources. You could read James Parkinson's original essay from 1817. It's quite insightful. Or watch documentaries like Still, a Michael J. Fox movie, for a very personal look at Parkinson's. For Alzheimer's, films like Still Alice or The Father offer incredibly powerful perspectives. For Huntington's, there's Dancing at the Vatican. And for ALS, The Theory of Everything gives insight into Stephen Hawking's life.
Great suggestions. Adds that crucial human dimension.
Exactly. So here's a final thought to leave you with. As you continue your studies, whether you become researchers or clinicians, try to engage with these stories. Explore these resources, not just to learn facts, but to cultivate empathy. Gaining that deeper, more holistic understanding of what it's like to live with these diseases, well, that's ultimately what fuels the most meaningful progress in this field.